Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Monday, I proposed an essay on the words essential and non-essential, as in having your work deemed vital or, you know, dispensable in times when public duty is best expressed in isolation. Here in the big epicenter, Governor Andrew Cuomo explained the essential.
Grocery stores need food, pharmacies need drugs, your internet has to continue to work, the water has to turn on when you turn the faucet, so there are essential services that will continue to function. And when I talk about the most drastic action we can take, this is the most drastic action we can take.
Many people, like we and the On the Media crew, can work, though it's tricky, from home. Not so sanitation workers, ambulance drivers, firefighters, mail carriers, who risk infection every day. Sometimes because they can't afford not to. Because lacking sufficient benefits or cash reserves, they have no choice.
We spoke with a taxi driver this morning, and we did take steps to maintain some social distancing. We set up the mic on a platform, on a Clorox wipe, sitting on a platform, and we each stood as 6 feet apart. We asked him about what it feels like to be considered an essential worker in this strange time.
Feeling like I'm doing a service to the community, but at the same time, it's a job, and that's how I've always looked at it. So I'm more here because I need to be driving taxi.
That was San Francisco. Here in New York City, the streets are pretty empty.
You know, I don't want the cure to be worse than the problem itself, the problem being obviously the problem.
If you're perplexed that the president of the world's contagion capital wants us all buying, selling, doing whatever the heck we do sooner rather than later, don't be. He sees the world in turmoil, and he seems to share the view of another president who said, economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive pronouncement. These wounds must be healed by the action of the cells of the economic body, the producers and consumers themselves. That, by the way, was Herbert Hoover.
We have to put the country to work. Look, you're going to lose a number of people to the flu, but you're going to lose more people by putting a country into a massive recession or depression.
Let's get back to work. Let's get back to living.
Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick told Tucker Carlson that he'd pay with his life to get the economy moving again.
No one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in.
That's when I realized my little rumination on the meaning of essential had been subsumed by a foundational clash over the relative value of lives and the urgent question of how to fuel the engines of market capitalism when that fuel, the only fuel, is literally locked away. For Glenn Beck, it's a no-brainer.
I would rather have my children stay home and all of us who are over 50 go in and keep this economy going and working. I'd rather die than kill the country, because it's not the economy that's dying, it's the country.
The utter collapse of the country's economy, which, you know, many think will happen if this goes on much longer, is an intolerable result.
Fox's Brit Hume acknowledged that COVID-19's death toll was a lot higher than the usual flu, but, quote, there we are.
You know, we don't shut down the economy to save every single life that's threatened by a widespread disease. We just don't.
So the choice is between America and Americans? You can't have both?
What are the qualities and the principles that we aspire towards and choose to defend?
That's actor Michael Sheen at a London rally in 2015 defending Britain's National Health Service.
Do we want to be a society that is fractured, divided, disconnected? Do we want to be a society that is suspicious and mistrustful of its own people? A society that is exploitative, that sees people as commodities? as numbers, mere instruments of profit, to be used while they have use, drained of whatever they can offer? Or do we want to be a society where all are equal in worth and value, and where that value is not purely a monetary one?
Are all equal in worth and value? The value of an actual life is generally seen as priceless, but the value of a statistical life, or as they call it, VSL, that's altogether different. VSL is calculated often by looking at the risks people are willing to take and at what price. Economists might ask you how much you'd pay to reduce your risk of dying, the cost of a smoke alarm, perhaps, or I don't know, a ventilator. But no one asks if you'd prefer to redirect $1 billion of the $17 billion reportedly earmarked to save Boeing and use it to buy 80,000 ventilators. So we'll set aside the messy VSL for the even messier VSLY, the value of a statistical life year. This is where legal scholar Cass Sunstein got into trouble. When considering the costs and benefits of a regulation, the EPA applied a constant statistical value to each life, irrespective of age. Sunstein thought that maybe it shouldn't. Maybe the lives of older people should count a little less because they've had so many more years to live. In fact, he said, maybe valuing the old and the young equally was actually unfair to younger people because it treats each of their anticipated years as less valuable than those of older people. Good point. Back to your dark satanic mill, Granddad. At least until this thing blows over, save the economy for the rest of us. So the young Sunstein, and he was young then, might cringingly acknowledge that Dan Patrick, Glenn Beck, Britt Hume, and so on might have a point, if they weren't offering a false choice. But they are. The country won't die, Glenn, nor the economy. Both are likely, though, to change. And with a little bit of the luck we've lately been lacking, that could be good. The great economist John Kenneth Galbraith said it would take nothing short of cataclysm or revolution for America's contented class to shake off its oblivion. In fact, he wondered, was this blinkered blitheness the American genius? We won't shake this off so easily. So, I ended the week having to acknowledge that the aid bill, while filled with disappointments and bucking up the plutocracy, puts money in the pockets of people who've long been drained and shunned by a government of the comfortably contented, a bill that wouldn't have been possible before the virus. The government already seemed perilously close to the edge, even before the viral rampage. Change was coming, one way or another.
One final thing. We've been working hard to get this show to you from our living rooms and kitchens and dungeons and so forth, and it has been challenging, but what about you? How have you been coping? OTM producer Asta Chaturvedi tweeted out that question last week, and here she is with a selection of your answers.
Hi, on the media. My name is Sarah. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois.
This is Bill Campbell in San Diego.
Aloha, my name's Jason, and I live on the island of Hawaii.
I'm Caroline Harrison. I'm recording this from Queens, New York.
This is Tucker from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
It's Aisling here in Ireland.
So last week we asked you how your coronavirus media diet is impacting your mental health.
I have PTSD and I am a regular consumer of news.
I'm not really sure how you could be paying attention to what's going on without being pretty depressed or anxious.
Honestly, the news surrounding this has all become a bit overwhelming.
I'm finding that when I don't listen to the news, I feel happier, but I have no idea what's going on. And then when I do listen to the news, I feel much more informed, but definitely more anxious.
And you told us about the different sources that you're using.
My wife, she's a nurse at the local hospital, so She's also on the front lines of this whole thing, and she's reading medical journals and trying to find the latest information.
I feel like the only place to really get up to the second news is on Twitter. But I really feel like it's this kind of bad news virus that is going around.
I'm not a big social media user. I have a Twitter account that in the past I would have interacted with maybe once every 2 weeks or so. But in the last week, that's been once every 15 minutes.
You told us about how it's really difficult to make sense of things and all the different kinds of questions that arise out of every new development.
I wonder what will happen to our society if even, say, half the worst-case scenario develops.
But you also told us about your coping mechanisms.
I think if there was a time that people looked to a trusted source, now is it.
So I am trying to, I guess, social distance myself from coronavirus news to help manage my anxiety.
We usually end the night by watching a few episodes of The Office on Netflix to try and regain sanity before going to bed.
And we'll give Aisling from Ireland the final word.
Yeah, I hope all the listeners are doing well and their families. Stay safe, everybody, and wash your hands.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Lana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Asta Chattavetti, and Zandra Ellen. We had more help from Anthony Bansi and Eloise Blondio, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.